All right, here we are, lawyertalkpodcast.com. That's where you can check us out, or you can check us out, or maybe you're over there. Anyway, we got a guest here today, Paul Scarsella. Paul, I think you maybe have been on the show before, but we're gonna chop it up here a little bit today. Paul's an attorney. We practice in the same office space. I've known Paul how long now? 30 years,
almost
probably?
30 years, yeah.
30 years, and he's been a prosecutor, he's been a defense lawyer, and he's been almost everything in between. And got lots of insight, and we're gonna take on a couple of these topics today. Paul, just start by introducing yourself.
Paul Scarsella, been an attorney since 1997 here in Ohio. I started as a prosecutor in Franklin County, and then worked kind of all over the state for about 20 years as a prosecutor. For the last 8-9 years, I've been doing criminal defense work, and I work out of the same office as Steve here on South High Street.
So what's fascinating about this, so what you guys don't know yet about Paul, we're going to talk about, is that you've probably tried more death penalty cases, certainly than anybody I know.
I've had a few, yeah.
On the prosecutor side.
As a prosecutor.
And more murder cases as a prosecutor than anybody I know.
I've had my share, yeah.
But now you do defense work, so you're like the true lawyer. You know, you just sort of take the law as it is, and you can do both sides of it.
That's kind of what it's supposed to be. It's the same fight. It's to make sure that the right people get locked up that need to be locked up and nobody's overstepping their bounds, whether that's the fight as a prosecutor, to making sure the cops are doing what they're supposed to be doing, to put forth the best case, because in essence, I'm lazy. I don't want to do my job twice, so I want to make sure that I get the right guy the first time. And then as a defense attorney, it's the same fight. I just want to make sure that everybody did their job right and the system will work if that's, in fact, what happens.
So let's rewind. Let's just tell a couple of war stories here. You've had some pretty big famous case, like national cases, as a prosecutor. And by that was with the Ohio Attorney General's office. You were sort of, I'm going to call it, the hired gun.
Yeah. So for 10 years, I worked for the Ohio Attorney General's office, where I would go around and help smaller counties with major felony cases, mostly homicides. So there was the Ohio Craigslist killing, which was in Noble and Summit County. I was involved in that.
What year? That was going back early
2013, 2014 was around that time. I worked there from 2007 through 2017. So during those 10 years, if there was a high profile homicide in Ohio, I probably was involved with it, other than the Pike County stuff. I was involved in a cold case up in Geauga County when that happened. So I got lucky and missed out on the Pike County case.
Oh, so you were still at the AG's when the Pike County case hit?
When the Pike County case came in, I was prosecuting a 10-year-old cold case up in Geauga County. So I was a little tied up, so they assigned it to somebody else. And I've never been happier to have been engaged in something
else. And it's still going on.
And it's still going on 10 years later. The case is still working its way through. So I'm glad I missed that one. I was okay with that one.
It's at least worthy of a little bit of explanation. You said Craigslist killer. Refresh our record.
Yeah, refresh it. Richard Beasley and Brogan Rafferty were two guys in Akron. Beasley was an older guy who had warrants out of Texas. He didn't want to go back to prison, so came up with a plan to avoid that by killing a homeless guy and taking his identity. And then putting an ad on Craigslist for people to come work at a farm in southeastern Ohio. And when they got there, he would kill them and take all of their stuff and sell it. So he killed three, wounded a fourth before he was eventually caught.
And that was all over. That was,
yeah, it was.
News.
Yeah, that made national news in 2000. Rolling Stone did an article on Brogan, the juvenile co-defendant, about how misunderstood and everything else he was.
Oh, he was misunderstood?
Misunderstood enough that he's running the Aryan Nation in ODRC, was last I heard, that he was very high up in that.
So
he was clearly misunderstood.
Just to be clear, what did he do?
Yeah, he was convicted of several counts of aggravated murder, including shooting a guy, Tim Kern, in the face 5 times.
Yeah, okay. So I can see the misunderstanding.
For $20.
No, right, it was worth it.
It's absolutely worth it.
What's interesting about, look, I'm a defense lawyer. I've been a defense lawyer for 31 years. My mentor, Bill Meeks, you and I knew him, but he always said, we don't represent causes. We represent clients.
That's it.
And so, I don't pick up the torch for the entire, I'm not the champion of all criminal defense issues around. I look at my case in front of me. I work that case. And as Bill used to say, why are you worrying about this stuff? Worry about the evidence. Everything else will fall into place. Worry about the case. Worry about the evidence. Do your job.
We used to say in our unit, Emily Pelfrey, who I tried a lot of cases with, who you also know, we used to say that you do the right thing for the right reasons, work the case the right way, and the politics will take care of itself. That's kind of how we drove everything as prosecutors, because there was so much politics that played into everything else. But if you did the right thing for the right reasons, making sure that, you know, you were seeking some sort of justice, then the politics would take care of itself. That wasn't going to be an issue. So similar to what Bill told you. Focus on the evidence, the case will work itself out. Now that I'm a defense attorney, I still kind of look at that same thing. I'm not worried about the politics of this issue or that issue. I'm worried about what do I need to do to protect my client to make sure that everything that he's not or she's not getting shafted by something. So that's, you look at the evidence, you look at what the cops did, and kind of go from there. And it's the same idea.
And I guess if we're looking at politics on the defense side, it is because the other side, the state, has not followed your rule. You know, they've injected, or there's a political bent to it. There's an umbrella over it, and then we've got to monkey with it, but it's still about working the case.
It's all about working the case. It's all about figuring out what the evidence shows, what is the right situation based upon the evidence and based upon what the rules are supposed to be, not what the dispatch or Channel 4 or the Delaware County Prosecutor's Office, just to pick on them a little bit, seems to think is the right situation. It's about that client and about the evidence that you have in front of you.
Gotcha. Well, look, we're going to talk one of the issues of the day, and you actually sent me, Paul, you sent me a text the other day and said, this would be a good podcast. And I was like, you're right, let's do it. And that's what we're going to do. And it's about plea bargaining. And there's been, this is not a new debate. There's been a huge debate about this for years, whether plea bargaining is taking away a defendant's right to go to trial, or whether it's a valuable tool, or whether it's somewhere in between. I want to get to that, so I'm not going to bury the lead of what we're really going to talk about today. But before we get to it, you've got a unique perspective, both as a prosecutor and a defense lawyer, and I think it's important to define what each of those roles are. Now, you and I both agree, we treat the cases the same, we treat the evidence the same, but the goal is different on both sides. I know the defense side. I go win the damn case at all costs, even if my client, I think he's guilty as the day is long. But on the prosecutor's side, I think I see a lot of that. I'm going to put this guy in prison no matter what, because I think he's guilty as the day is long, isn't necessarily where the case should come from.
No, what's funny is the Ohio Rules of Professional Conduct, with respect to lawyers, have a specific rule for prosecutors. They're the only segment of the legal community that has their own specific rule in the Ohio Rules of Professional Conduct. And what it says is that they are ministers of justice. A prosecutor is not supposed to get a conviction at all costs. They are supposed to see that justice is done. Sometimes justice means dismissing a case. Sometimes justice means reducing a case to fit the facts. Sometimes justice, reducing a plea bargain or something along those lines. Sometimes justice means making sure that someone gets the death penalty because that's what's appropriate. But it's not a blanket. And that, I think that's where things have kind of gotten off track in the last 15, 20 years, I think. It's more about, I used to say that there were prosecutors and then there were politicians elected to the office of prosecutor. And the number of prosecutors was diminishing over time. And I can't remember the last time I saw a prosecutor rather than a politician elected to that office. Because it's an elected office, I think those politics have started to drive more and more of how cases get evaluated, how cases get indicted, and then eventually how cases get resolved, whether it's based upon the view of narcotics and how they want to handle it, or violent crime. You know, every prosecutor is going to have their specific bent as to what they're going to focus on. And that colors how cases get reviewed and how cases get handled. And I don't think there's any question that the way prosecutors have been evaluating cases over the last 15, 20 years has significantly changed, at least from my perspective.
Well, you've identified sort of the political. So what you're saying is, look, there's a political side to this. So which is really what you're saying, is about getting votes.
Absolutely.
So it looks like you're being tough on crime, damn it, even if you might be wrong.
Yeah, you might be tough on crime. Everything is a weakness. Everything is a strategy. And from the political stand, everything plays into that. It's not about, okay, we have this search that may have been questionable, so maybe we shouldn't be pushing this case. Well, it's a major drug case. There's guns involved. We have to look like we're being hard on guns and tough on crime, you know, so we can't absolutely do something about that. You know, each case is going to have it, and not every case has this. There are cases that politics don't play into it. It's just a straight run-of-the-mill criminal case, and the cops did their job right. But there are those occasional cases where there is something significant and politics plays a part. You also see it based just on the way that, you know, an office runs a case, and that policy and that culture starts to develop throughout an office of prosecutors, whether they're young prosecutors that learn from the older ones, especially like in the DV unit or the drug unit. Everybody kind of develops this mentality that their unit's the most important, and that they have to, they fight the toughest cases, so they have to be the toughest about this.
And by DV, you mean domestic violence?
Domestic violence and special victims units.
Gotcha.
The Cook County District Attorney's Office in Chicago used to have a sign in their gang unit that said, "Convicting the guilty is easy. It's getting those innocent bastards that's hard."
That's got, what a great quote.
Some of it means, some of it is that there are people who walk in and know that they've been caught and they're professional about it, and you know the case gets resolved. There are other people who protest their innocence until the very end. And sometimes a prosecutor does have to go after those innocent people if they believe that the evidence shows that. Other times in Cook County, maybe they weren't so guilty.
So you're talking about this political bent all the way at the local level. Let me throw something at you. What, just in my practice, the things I've seen. Pre 9/11, I had a federal drug case, a handful of them privately hired almost all the time. At any given time, you look in my file drawer, you could open it up and say, federal drugs, conspiracy, money laundering, all the federal drug stuff. Post 9/11, that almost dried up. Because the federal government was now focused on terrorism.
Mm-hmm.
And then Obama gets elected, and now I've got all sorts of federal gun case, which are like regulatory stuff. So what I'm talking about is not violent crime, but rather somebody's not filing the proper forms when they're manufacturing, pairing, or dealing with firearms. And then after that, the drug cases started to come back. I mean, it just, there's an ebb and flow in what's getting prosecuted on the big level. And you can almost see who's in the White House and in charge of the DOJ, Department of Justice, and what kind of crimes are ultimately going to get prosecuted. I mean, mortgage fraud cases, well, those were all the rage after 2008. I had tons of them. I haven't had one in a long time. And maybe there was more mortgage fraud back then, but you and I both know that that's not true, right?
No.
So I've always said, if you want to get rid of crime, just quit defining it in a certain way. So you want to get rid of domestic violence, start calling them assaults.
Right.
You know, because they'll still be the same crime, but it'll just be called differently statistically.
And I think what you see is every political situation has that kind of bent to it. So in Franklin County, we're seeing a change in the politics here. It's becoming a little bit more democratic, a little bit more progressive. So there's all kinds of stuff and talk about restorative justice and things along those lines. But at the same time, you still have a homicide rate that is climbing. From some years are higher than others, but it's still relatively violent in Columbus right now. You can pick up the paper pretty much every day, and there's at least one shooting a day, if not more. And I think you see political leaders trying to balance those progressive ideas of, you know, minimizing police involvement, more social workers, things along those lines, coupled with the fact that you still have a rather violent community going on. So trying to balance those two competing interests, you'll see that in dealing with our cases in Common Pleas Court in Franklin County right here. You go one county north, and they don't have those same progressive ideas up in Delaware County. So it's a much more hard knocks. This is the way it's going to be. You violated the law, so you're going to get the maximum punishment. And I think that's one of the big things that most people don't realize, is that there's one revised code in the state of Ohio, but there's 88 different ways that it gets applied.
Yeah.
And it gets applied based upon who the county prosecutor is and which judge you're in front of. And some counties have one judge, some have two, some have 17. And that difference as to how that law gets applied, and this plays into the ideas behind plea bargaining and everything else, depends a lot on who the county prosecutor is and who the judge is. Because all of those things go into play, whether you're a prosecutor trying to evaluate your case or you're a defense attorney trying to adequately advise your client. All of those things play a huge role in how the case is going to ultimately get resolved.
All right, one more thing we're going to cover, and then we're going to talk about plea bargaining. Although we are talking about the foundations of what the plea bargaining problem issue, what the issues may or may not be. We talked about political bent and bias. I injected the word bias. Political influence, we'll say, over prosecutions. But I also want to talk about, because this is really important for the plea bargaining discussion, what I'll call individual bias or interest in a case, because what I find fascinating about our system, and you and I are both sort of, I don't want to call us scholars, but we both study what the founding fathers tried to do.
Right.
And we're all human. And it's impossible not to build a criminal justice system or a governmental structure without using humans, because we are all human. I happen to believe that we all suffer fatal flaws as humans. You know, none of us are perfect. or none of us is perfect. And so we're building a system with imperfection baked into the equation. One of those imperfections is ego and pride. And these things, I think, permeate our system. And our founding fathers tried to address this by creating checks and balances. And, you know, the one department can't do this, or one branch of government can do this, but the other checks it here and the other checks it here. And we're going to make it up of multiple people. So hopefully the sum and substance of it is better than the individual parts. That's my rant. But from this, the system, as you said, puts on the onus on the prosecutors to do justice. At the same time, we call it an adversarial system, or another word for that would be a fighting system. You and I both played football. You don't go into a football. You go, like, at least for that 60 minutes, I hate that SOB in front of me, and I'm going to kick the crap out of him, and I'm going to win this at all costs. And then afterwards, we might go get pizza. But for that time, I hate him, and I want to win. And I want to win not just because I want to win. I want to win because I want to win, damn it. And how, as a prosecutor, do you grapple with that, juxtapose your duty to do justice?
I guess I can tell a war story, and I think maybe that explains it. So I had a particularly nasty triple homicide up in Erie County in Sandusky. Defendant was charged with killing a woman and her two children and doing things that you shouldn't have done to any of the three of them. And we're sitting there, and death penalty voir dire, as you know, is a little bit different. And you have to go through the panel first to see if they can be quote-unquote death qualified. Are they able to listen to all of the evidence before making a decision? It's a whole process that you go through. And I was there with the elected county prosecutor in Erie County and two defense attorneys that I highly respected. And my thought process going through death penalty voir dire as a prosecutor was, I'm lazy, I don't want to do this twice, and this is the area that's most likely going to cause a reversal down the way. So I'm not going to push real hard because I think somebody's pro-death. I want to make sure that the jury panel is appropriate because, one, I don't want to have to do my job a second time, and two, I think that's what the law says. The law says you're supposed to get people that are independent of, you know, they're not automatic death, they're not automatic life. They're going to listen to everything. And there was one particular juror that the county prosecutor was pushing for, and the defense attorney leaned over and said, I'm rooting for you, knowing that he was probably going to create an error. And it's a little joke, and it's a little thing that happens in the courtroom when the jury's not there and we're all talking because of the professionalism. And I leaned over to the county prosecutor. I'm like, hey, this is one we want to pass on. This is not a hill we want to die on because the evidence is really, really strong and things along those lines.
So this prosecutor's saying, I really like this juror. This is a pro death. This is a hanging juror.
This juror's going to walk in and be death penalty, death penalty, death penalty.
And you're
right off the bat.
The local guy's saying, yeah, yeah, yeah. Let's act like he's not. Or let's do whatever we can to get this guy on the jury, because then it's more likely our guy. And the defense lawyers are keen to this, right?
And the defense attorney knew exactly what was going on, which is why he jokingly said, I'm rooting for you. I hope you get this one, because he knew it was going to be an issue that they could then raise on appeal.
Yeah.
And I'm like, this is not an issue we want down the road.
So the interest in winning is overcoming the overarching.
His interest in getting a death verdict was more important than the bigger picture. The bigger picture being, I make sure that justice gets done. At least that's my ego telling me that that's what I was involved in. Part of me was like, this dude's probably going to get the death penalty no matter what, based upon what he's done. So let's move it along and not fight a fight that could cost us longer down the road. That professionalism, I think, is kind of getting washed out of the system. When we first started here in Franklin County, prosecutors and defense attorneys would litigate a case and fight like cats and dogs. And immediately, as soon as that jury went back to the jury room to deliberate, where did we go? We went across the street to the jury room, and everybody sat down and they had a cocktail and they talked about the strategy and they talked about the case and they laughed about it and they joked about it. And then they all went back and got their verdicts together. Because it's a community that works together on a daily basis. We see the same people in our courthouse every day. And that familiarity can sometimes breed problems as well. But you have to be able to maintain that competitiveness, like you said, with a football game where you want to kick the crap out of somebody for 60 minutes and then just go hang out with them after.
Yeah.
There's nothing wrong with that. And I think that adversarial system is the base. That's the check on the criminal justice system, right? Because the only thing that works is my ability to cross-examine the witness as a defense attorney, your ability as a defense attorney to frame a legal argument that fits, that maybe the judge has not thought about before, that maybe get some evidence kicked out. Because it's that willingness to fight for your client, coupled with the prosecutor's desire to see that justice is done, whatever he or she may think that is, it's that competition that works this system out. Nothing about this needs to be collaborative. You don't have to fight about everything, but a collaboration on this probably isn't going to get the result that's the most appropriate.
So here's a dilemma that I run into a lot. And probably for obvious reasons, it typically emerges when you have a very young prosecutor. The young prosecutor wants to win. And it's not about that sort of becomes the overriding motivation is to win. And you know, it may be that they feel like they have righteousness on their side because the guys are no good, rotten SOB, and therefore I want to win, and I want to win at all costs, even if it means I'm not going to I'm going to ignore my duty to do justice, where I'm going to look the other way when I know there's evidence out there the police didn't give me. I'm going to look the other way because this guy's guilty anyway. And I'm not saying this happens a lot. I'm not saying it doesn't happen a lot, but it does happen. And it's sort of like the duty to supply exculpatory evidence, for instance, is given to the prosecutor whose job it is to prosecute the guy. So it's like you have to give the good stuff to the other side that they can then use against you to win the case.
Right.
And it just seems like that is in conflict with the adversarial system.
But it's not, if you really look at it, because your point is that the prosecutor is supposed to do justice. Look, as a prosecutor, I learned from guys that were older than me that you would give the whole, because discovery was different when we first started. Now we get pretty much, we're supposed to get open file discovery. We're supposed to get everything that the prosecutor has. Back then it was, you get a little snippet of stuff.
And all right, let me stop here. I need you to look in the camera. I did an episode on this, and people are skewering me. This guy's an idiot. He doesn't know what he's talking about. Ohio, we used to get nothing.
No.
I mean nothing.
So like, and I started as an intern in the prosecutor's office, okay? And as an intern in the prosecutor's office in 1995, before the change in discovery rules and everything else, it was the intern's job to get discovery. And the only thing we had to give were statements of the defendant. So if there was one line in the U-10-100, which was the police report. Right? The handwritten.
10-page typed or written report.
Or the one-hand page written report on our, you know, the police stopped the car because they had a taillight burnout. They pulled them over. There was an odor of a smell of marijuana. The defendant said, F you, cop. What we would do is we would make a copy of that. We would cut out the F you, cop. Tape it to a piece of blank paper, put that on the copy machine, and that's what the defense attorney got in discovery.
Yeah.
The names of the officers involved.
Listen to him.
The names of the officers involved and just the statement of the defendant, F you cop. And that was it. That was all that you got in discovery. Maybe the lab results for the drugs that were recovered.
So this is an aside. We're going to take it anyway.
So, but the point of the matter is, as a prosecutor, your job is to do justice. So you have to give them everything. And if you give them everything, then there's no problem putting that up in front of a jury and letting the jury make the decision.
Right.
It's not your decision as a prosecutor if he's guilty or not. That is the jury's decision.
Yeah, take the case in a courtroom and prove it.
And prove it. And if your case is strong enough and you are persuasive enough, then you'll win your case. Everything seems to be in the prosecutor's office these days. They believe that promotion and advancement in their career is based upon winning cases. Or moving them off the docket. And that's why you get into some of the problems you get into.
And one more comment, and then we'll get into this plea bargaining notion. And all this is a precursor to the plea bargaining discussion. Right?
Because this plays into the plea bargaining. Yeah. Without any of this, there is no plea bargaining.
That's right. So I often have noticed another phenomenon here where I've become look, I think I've earned a pretty decent professional reputation in Ohio.
Right.
And I go talk to a prosecutor, and we're talking, and we're getting along just fine. And then, you know, the lights go on, and the kickoff starts, and I start cross-examining their star witness or the victim or whatever. And I can just see the prosecutor seething over there, pissed off, and, you know, screaming. You know, at a break on this happened. This is a true story. At a break, it was a hearing, not a trial. I went over to the prosecutor, and he's freaking furious. And I said, well, dude, you didn't think that I was just going to not do anything, did you? I mean, did you think that I wasn't going to get up here and challenge your case because we know each other? I said, I still respect you. I think you're a decent prosecutor, but I'm doing my damn job, man. And if that is, I've lost friendships over that.
Yeah, that professionalism seems seems to be missing. Like, you don't, there is no more going to the jury room. There is no more of that. I tried a murder case a couple of years ago with prosecutors who I respected. I said, hey, I'm going to go across the street while I'm waiting on the verdict. You guys are welcome to come over. No, we can't.
Mm-hmm. It's changed.
It just doesn't, it's not there, right? It's that professionalism is gone. That respect among peers, among colleagues, seems to have been gone. And I don't know if it was the defense bar that did it. I don't know if the prosecutors that did it. I just noticed it's gone.
Well, I think it's the generation that did it. I think it's a newer generation doesn't operate as the older generation. And it may be good, it may be bad. It is what it is. And there are probably people that say that's good because you guys are all in bed. I get these comments all the time. You guys are in bed together anyway. It's all rigged. It all is. And this will get us right to where we wanted to start, which is plea bargaining.
Yep.
So the big debate, you know, on the one side, there's people, there's advocates saying plea bargaining is destroying somebody's constitutional right to a trial. On the other side, they're saying, well, that's there's no way we can try every single case. It would be overwhelming for the system. What do you do with that?
And I think there are some cases that don't need to go to trial. There are some cases that where they're appropriately indicted, they're appropriately charged. And there is some benefit to a client accepting responsibility and moving forward with their life and, you know, accepting the punishment. You know, are there cases where plea bargaining is appropriate? Yeah. And I think the majority of them, the case is getting resolved by plea isn't necessarily problematic. What we do see is that there are times where there may be an overindictment, there may be overcharging in an attempt to have that person then resolve the case by a plea. You see this sometimes, or used to see it sometimes, with homicides and things along those lines. There would be a capital component attached to the indictment with the anticipation that there will be a plea to a non-death kind of sentence.
Yeah, so this is one of the big criticisms. And what you're describing to me is a car deal. I'm going to go in and the dealer is going to say, all right, here's your sticker price. You know, we'll be happy to sell it to you. And they go back to their boss and they come out with the little four squares and they say, here you go.
Yep.
You know, here you go. We're going to sell it to you for $30,000, which is the, wait a minute, I just looked at the window of the car and it said $30,000. I don't get, how about a little something, you know,
right,
for the effort. And in the criminal system, they changed the start point because they wanted to get to the end point. And the start point would have been, all right, let's say the actual case is just a straight murder. In Ohio, that would be 15 to life. If you've got a gun, call it 18 to life. What you're saying is a lot of times prosecutors would indict a death penalty murder because they knew what they ultimately wanted was the guy to plead to a straight murder. And if we die in a death penalty murder, then he'll be more likely to take this deal because it looks good and it feels like you're getting something.
Yep.
And then you can take that all the way down the line. It could be a straight murder, and then we'll indict the straight murder, even though we know it's probably a manslaughter. So we'll just indict the manslaughter. The problem, I can't say that's necessarily a problem because when you go to another jurisdiction, Licking County used to be this way, a county out east in Ohio used to be this way. There was no plea bargaining after indictment, but they would only indict what they thought they could prove.
Right.
So on the one hand, it felt like I'm telling my clients, look, there's no plea bargaining, man. You get indicted on this, that's it. You're going to plead guilty to that or you're going to trial. Or... is it better to start with something higher and feel like you're getting a deal? So I don't know.
And I think I grew up in a furniture store. My dad sold furniture growing up. And I used to say, so how's this store come up and offer 30% off? He goes, well, because they jacked the price up 50% before they knock it down
30%. Right, right. So what we have here is a shell game.
So. Yeah, so, right. And there's not a whole lot of difference going on sometimes in these cases, right? And different counties operate differently, just like you said. So... some counties will indict things just because it technically fits the statute. That doesn't necessarily fit the facts, but it technically fits the statute. And then you're kind of stuck with it. So you take, say, for example, a series of theft offenses. That seems to be the one most common these days, at least around here in Ohio. You'll have an organization or a couple of people who are committing a bunch of different theft offenses. Well, what prosecutors will then do is they'll lump them together and call it an enterprise.
Yeah.
Retail theft enterprise.
Think RICO.
Yeah. So now they're going to jack you up on a RICO charge and engaging in a pattern of corrupt activity. So all your low-level felonies are now felonies of the second degree.
Right. We're 15 years ago. We're fighting maybe a 5-10 year stretch. Now it's a mandatory 10 plus more.
Plus fines and court costs and everything else. So now you're at a situation where you've got a client who has all of these things, and he thinks there's some misdemeanors and some felonies, and maybe he's going to go look at 2 or 3 years, but you know, the prosecutor wants him to do 8. And if he's convicted at trial, he could do 12 or 14. So this is where the risks and rewards that we talk about sometimes with our clients, it comes into play. And this is the plea bargaining.
So the criticism of that would be, look, you're starting with a RICO, or you've made this charge that could be small, but let's just add to our little example here that, you know what? The guy was wearing a mask the entire time. There's no DNA evidence. Couple eyewitnesses, but they're a little shaky. Maybe some grainy surveillance video. But it was the defendant's wife's car or something. There's just a little bit of circumstantial evidence that the guy did it, meaning I am creating a factual scenario that gives me a defense to the case. But if I go to trial on the RICO and lose, my guy's doing 20 years. So I'm going to take a deal, and therefore they would argue, or the collective the opponents of plea bargaining would argue, you're depriving my client of a right to trial by jury because he really doesn't have any choice. He's got to plead. Because if he goes to trial on this and gets whacked, it's life-ending.
Right.
So he's just got to plead. And this happens, you know. So if I have a guy who says, listen, I didn't do this, you know, what it's like the old, I forget, I think it was it's the old cartoon, the Christmas movie. I didn't do it.
Yeah.
I didn't do it. Poor expression.
Yeah.
You know, I didn't do this. I need to go to trial. And I'm like, listen, I'm your Huckleberry, man. We'll go tee it up. But I'm not doing my job unless I tell you, if you're convicted, you're doing at least 10. And I can't change that. And he's like, I don't have a choice. I got to take that. His wife is saying, you got to take that. You know, so I get it. You know, there's a legitimate criticism. So as a prosecutor, what was the prosecutorial thought of that?
Prosecutorial thought for me was, one, I don't think we used the RICO statute the same way when I was a prosecutor.
Yeah, in that example,
I don't ever remember using it on. I remember one time there was a theft organization that I was tangentially involved in Franklin County, but I used it on a major narcotics investigation that we were both involved in Delaware County. And that kind of fit the situation better, I thought, based upon the way that enterprise was working and things along those lines. I never really thought of using it on one person who was going in and committing a bunch of thefts, especially if there was some narcotics issues or things along those lines that played into that part. Use issues for the person, right? You know, a lot of those kinds of repeat theft offenders are always kind of drug seeking or something along those lines. So I just never used it. I did see some of that behavior with respect to the homicides. I always, at least from my perspective, I indicted what I thought I could prove. And then there had to be a reason for me to come off of that, some evidentiary reason or some other reason. So I had a death penalty case in Lawrence County down in Ironton when I was with the AG's office. And it was a horrible case. A guy had set his estranged...
Factually horrible.
Set his estranged wife on fire in bed with the 11-year-old. So yeah, just nasty case. And I resolved it. It would have been an easy death penalty case in Lawrence County. It would have been an easy trial. It would have been easy to stick to the death penalty. But I would have had to have his daughter testify against him. So she would have lost her mom in the fire and then had to testify against dad, who eventually would have gone to death row. There's no question in Lawrence County he was going to get the death penalty.
Did you indict the death penalty?
I did indict the death penalty because it fit the statute at the time.
Yep.
And after talking to the family and after talking to Emily, the little girl, and everybody else, we made the decision, and it was, I believe, the right decision to offer something short of death, where we knew he probably wasn't going to have a legitimate shot at parole, but there was at least some hope for him.
But this isn't a situation. The difference here you're describing, though, and I'm just going to make the assumption, I guess, there was no defense.
No, he was clearly guilty.
He could not go into a trial and win.
Clearly guilty. And the state public defender knew that. So it was all going to be about the death penalty. And to me, and it goes into the plea bargaining, right? It's the death penalty was the plea bargain. The sentence was the plea bargain, whether it's the 8 years on the racketeering stuff for the thefts where you're looking at 40 or a life sentence with some eligibility for parole or you're looking at the death penalty. We don't plea bargain charges. We plea bargain time. That's what everybody out there, the collective they, has to understand. We plea bargain for time. That's what this is about.
A lot, most of the time.
Yeah, 90% of the time, we're plea bargaining for time. Yeah. And in this situation, those were the kinds of plea bargains I tried to do. There had to be some reason for that. And if I didn't think it was a death case, I wouldn't have indicted it as a death case.
See, that's a legitimate plea bargain to me. You know, you indict the... I mean, that makes sense because I don't think in that scenario, at least as applied there, the defense is deprived of his right to a trial by jury because he can't win anyway. The ones where it gets dicey is when there's a defense, when where the evidence isn't a slam dunk, where it's a child sex case and the girl is saying this, there are no witnesses, the guy's denying it, the guy's got no history of any sort of abuse. It comes in the context of a marital breakup mm-hmm. or a stepdad scenario, and there's custody battles, like all the classic trimmings.
We've had those cases too. As a prosecutor, I am lucky enough to be able to say that I never had a situation where I felt that. I've had murders that I've dismissed. I've had other cases that I've dismissed where I don't feel like the evidence had warranted me going to trial or even offering a plea. I've had that situation as a defense attorney where there's no choice. I have to go to trial.
Yeah.
And sometimes you win and sometimes you don't. And it's frustrating. It's so scary.
I get this all the time. Not that I get it. I hear this all the time. You probably do. I would never plead guilty to something I know I didn't do. And to that, I always say, well, you've never been accused of something that is like this. Because if you're accused of the kind of crime we're talking about. So let's say you go home. You've got a wife and she's got an ex and there's daughters involved and you've helped raise those kids for 20 years or 10 years rather. And next thing you know, you come home and the cops are there and you're getting taken away in handcuffs because one of the girls is accusing you of a child of sexual abuse. And you go talk to somebody like you or somebody like me. And we go through the outline of how you defend these cases for a different day, but it's a huge chore.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't bury the lead. I tell people, look, man, you lose, you're going to prison for the rest of your life. Now, they may say 10 to life, but there's four counts. So it's really 40 to life in this mm-hmm. jurisdiction. And if you go to trial and lose, you're not getting out of prison, at least not when you're young. And the guy's like, but I didn't do anything. So when those guys go to trial, it is literally for all the marbles. It is everything. And yeah, maybe they did it, maybe they didn't do it, but the evidence isn't clear by any measure. It just happens to be some young girl says so. And people, that's the tougher one for me. Those kind of, you better take the deal to plead guilty to a low-level sex offense and you're on the reporting list for the rest of your life and you're going to go do 5 years in prison, or you risk everything and you go to trial and lose and you're never getting out. And I have had it both ways, as I'm sure you have. I've won cases where I thought, no chance in hell, I should have won that case. And I've lost cases where I thought, this is a huge miscarriage of justice.
Yep. But that's the system. And yep. I think those plea bargains, that's a tougher case to talk about, right? Because you have a victim in that situation that, well, for a defense attorney walking into trial on those, there is no presumption of innocence. I don't care how many times you voir dire it.
Right.
The minute the jury hears that those are the allegations going on, it's your job as the defense attorney to prove your client innocent.
Yeah.
The state has relieved of their burden of proving your client guilty.
But in practice.
Not legally, but practicality. The burden has shifted on right. those kinds of cases.
Right.
So that's an aspect that has to be evaluated with your client, you know, and you have to talk about that with your client. And ultimately, it's the client's decision. Where it becomes more difficult for me from a plea bargain standpoint is with the narcotics offenses, with the property offenses that they seem to have overcharged. That, to me, is where you tend to get more of a plead guilty, do some time to avoid a more significant penalty where you maybe lose your right to have a trial. The child sex offense cases, there's a ton at risk. And it's only the jury that's ever going to tell you that you're not guilty. You're never going to convince a prosecutor, no matter what. No matter what evidence you are able to present,
yep.
no matter what you're able to develop as a defense attorney, the only people who are ever going to give you that exoneration is going to be a jury of 12. So,
and even that, you can walk away a winner in the court of public opinion.
It doesn't matter. Because even if you're acquitted, you're still marked with that scarlet letter for the rest of your life, no matter what.
As so, I've often said to jurors, I often say to my voir dire, or my, when I'm talking to jurors in those cases, I would say, all right, how many agree that false accusations of child sex abuse happen? Almost every hand goes up.
Mm-hmm.
So we all agree. And we might even talk about a case in Texas or another case where there's been an exoneration because of a recantation, like a concrete
right.
didn't happen. Now, how many think that the people prosecuting, the people sitting over there where you would be sitting as a prosecutor and the cop over here and the social worker over there thought it was a false accusation when they were prosecuting it? None.
Not a one.
And I've had cases where even, I mean, literally my closing argument was, look, we all know that this is, that this guy's not guilty. There's only one person here that doesn't know that. And that's the prosecutor, right? That's a rare argument you get to make that. But the point is that those are emotionally charged messes.
They are. And there's, and you have a whole system that's set up to believe the child. That nobody ever questions the child, right? So whether it's the social worker who does the quote-unquote forensic interview, you know, to keep the child from the additional harm of multiple interviews where inconsistencies might come out. And then you have that social worker who will testify that she's never had a child lie to them. That's not her job to figure that out. It's just to allow that report, and then they provide that information to the medical providers. I mean, we've created a system that makes it almost impossible to truly challenge that type of testimony. But that's the what, as a defense attorney, that's what you have to try and explain to your client. And yes, there is an offer on the table. And yes, that offer probably means less time or less time on the registration or something along those lines. The question becomes, how much tolerance for pain does your client have?
What's your risk tolerance?
Because that's what this is going to come down to. And that's plea bargaining in and of itself, I don't think is inherently bad because of that. I think there are ways to try and resolve cases, but it's where you're using a hammer of 12 years in prison for what amounts to a bunch of thefts. That's where I seem to see more of an issue with it than a child allegation and that. But again, that may just be my perspective.
Well, we're getting to where another topic I wanted to cover, which is we talked about a little bit, the separation of powers, because really in the justice system, we have all three at work. Mm-hmm. You have the executive branch, which is really the prosecutors. You have the legislative branch, which is the legislators writing laws and creating possible sentences. Then you have judges whose job it is to impose the punishment, keep everybody sort of civil. And so what is your experience dealing with, because I've actually done this, where I am in a certain, say in Franklin County, I'd like to say all judges are built equally. They're not, but still within the bounds of the law. So I know a judge, look, this is a theft case, so therefore this judge is going to be easy on it, or this judge is going to be hard on it. This is a certain cases you just know, luck of the draw, man, you got the hanging judge for rape cases. No matter what the outcome, it's max. I have engaged in plea bargaining with the executive branch prosecutors to help keep that in check. And what's your thought on the validity of that?
Oh, I think you have to take all of it into account. So especially you have the audience of who your prosecutor is. So like, do you have a prosecutor who's part of a specialized unit, because they're going to look at their cases differently than your run-of-the-mill felony prosecutor in Franklin County, where we have a bunch of different units, you know? And you also have to take into account who the judge is, without a doubt. I mean, there are judges where it really doesn't necessarily matter kind of what the plea is. You've got a really good shot that you're going to get community control based upon
probation.
Upon certain factors that may be present in your case. So you want to be able to work those angles with respect to the judge. So you may take a plea to a higher level felony, knowing that you have some good information that you can put in front of the judge to get probation at a sentencing. So you may not negotiate as much of a reduction in the offense. So you may plead to the felonious assault without a specification, but know that you can pretty much get your guy probation on a felonious assault. Whereas with other judges, you may want that felonious assault reduced down to more like an ag assault, because you know the judge is going to sentence, so you don't want to have that. And so all of that plays into it.
Yeah, so
all of it plays into it.
In real numbers, say you've got in Ohio, we'd have a charge like you called a felonious assault. The maximum sentence on that would be 8 years. And let's just take a fact scenario. My son goes out, has 4 or 5 beers at a bar. Somebody's picking on his girl, and they go out, and they're going to settle it in the parking lot. And my son punches the guy in the nose, breaks his nose. Gets charged with felonious assault. 22-year-old kid, never been in trouble before, charged with felonious assault, which is causing either with a deadly, in this situation, be
serious physical harm,
a broken nose. And, you know, the choice is go to trial on a self-defense case, but broken nose happened after his two punches too many. So you're thinking, got a little, bit of liquid courage with the alcohol and one punch too many. Didn't need to do that. It's a hard self-defense case. But he's charged with an 8-year felonious assault. I go to one judge and I plead guilty in front of that judge. I know that, look, this judge is sympathetic and just as a light sentencer, so probably getting probation.
Mm-hmm. You got your client into drug and alcohol treatment while the case is pending. You can show that they're doing what they're supposed to do, provided you can get them out on bond. Doing everything that they're supposed to do. They're back in school or they're working and, you know, all of that. Yeah, you're getting a probation. And then some other judge with that same fact scenario, they're going to do 3 years.
Or 8.
Right.
And there are counties in Ohio where that's an 8-year stretch, yep, no matter how you slice it up. So that, and look, the prosecutors know that, the defense lawyers know that, and it changes the outcome of the plea negotiations. So I might successfully argue with the prosecutor and negotiate the case down to a significantly lesser charge, because we both know that as soon as we go in and present this to the judge, my guy's getting the max.
Right.
So like you said at the beginning, we're arguing time. So look, we agree, my client agrees, everybody agrees, all right, went too far, it's probably a 3-year, the needle falls at 3 years fairly and squarely, and we all sort of can get our heads around that. But we know if we plead guilty as charged, it's an 8-year.
Mm-hmm.
So the prosecutor's we're gonna change it and make it something that we know the judge is gonna give him 3 years. And this, by the way, might be a judge, it doesn't tell us in advance what they're gonna do, what he or she'll do. Some judges do, some judges don't, you just never know. But it's part of the equation.
And I think that kind of gets back to the whole idea of plea bargaining, right? There's no, and it's a concept that's hard to explain either to jurors in voir dire or to judges sometimes, but there's nothing automatic about the criminal justice system. A broken nose doesn't mean 8 years. A broken nose may mean 8 years in Muskingum County. A broken nose in Franklin County may be probation.
Yeah, or maybe
on the fourth floor.
Maybe even a pass if you make restitution.
Yeah, it may be probation on the fourth floor, but it may be 2 years on the seventh floor. It just, mm-hmm, you know, these are all of the things that, so there's nothing automatic about any of this. So this idea that you can spit into a computer the facts of a situation and get the same result every time, that doesn't apply. And I don't think it should, because each defendant is different. Each victim is different. Each set of facts is different. And you talked earlier about the founders building this system of checks and balances based upon those differences. We are all human. And now this system does the best it can to take all of that into account. So whether you're a prosecutor, whether you're a defense attorney, you should take each individual defendant, witness, victim into account in making what you believe to be the appropriate resolution.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of times what happens is the system just gets overwhelmed. And you just need to move this file from this part of your desk to that part of your desk. So you don't really care if it's a 22-year-old kid who just graduated from college, who has a good job, who has a good girlfriend, who's never been in trouble before. You just see the broken nose. And as a defense attorney, sometimes you can get overwhelmed. So you don't really care that to talk to him enough to figure all of that out, you're just going to rush to maybe move that file to this one.
That's where it gets dangerous, doing what we do. You know, this is the rub. Like, we can't do that. We can't let
go. As a prosecutor, you shouldn't either.
Yeah.
I don't care how busy you are.
I agree. The prosecutor shouldn't, and really, on both sides can't. But it happens.
It happens all the time, and it happens every day. And it happens to good lawyers. It happens to bad lawyers. It happens to everybody involved, because we're people. And I think that third area of the checks and balances, that legislative system.
Yeah, this is a big problem.
That the legislative system has, I think, created a lot of the problem here, because what the founders thought was that you would go in, take care of a few things, and go back to your farm or go back to your law practice or go back to your business. They never anticipated the business that became politics.
Mm.
They never anticipated that this was going to be your career. So if this is your career, you have to do something. I was at the gym last night, and we were talking about those e-bikes that are around. And the consensus was that one of these kids up in, you know, one of the nice little suburbs is going to end up getting clipped by somebody. And the next thing you know, we're going to have Ethan's Law or Logan's Law.
Yeah.
Because we had to have a knee-jerk reaction to something.
As one of my a good judge, he was a municipal court judge, said any law named after somebody is invariably going to be a bad one.
Right.
Right.
But what ends up happening is you have professionals, politicians who get elected to these offices who have to do something. So every year they have to pass another bill to change the penalties for this or to increase the penalty for that or to add an additional specification for this. Because otherwise...
So this manifested itself in a very real way from, I think, 1980 until the early 2000s. I'm guessing on the dates, guys. Forgive me. In federal court.
Mm-hmm.
Through the first half of my career, I practiced in federal court under the constraints of the United States sentencing guidelines, which on their face were designed to create some parity in sentencing, some equality in sentencing. So somebody charged with a drug case in Arkansas would be treated the same as in Ohio or California or New York. So in all its infinite wisdom, Congress created an agency, or the government created the executive branch created an agency, and the agency created these rules, and the rules were the sentencing guidelines, and they became mandatory. And this is where plea bargaining really went haywire in federal court, because I could have, say, a cocaine case or a crack cocaine case with a half a defense, but if I lost, the guidelines were astronomical, just horrific, and the judge didn't have any authority to do anything else. So the judge would say, look, even though I could go down to nothing or a five-year minimum, the guidelines are shaken out at 15 years here, 20 years. I don't have any discretion. So if you go to trial and lose, you're doing 20 years. So federal practice immediately became a plea bargaining practice.
Mm-hmm.
And this is where the real pushback on plea bargaining started. I never got to practice before the guidelines. They were in place when I passed the bar exam. I practiced since the guidelines. And you would think that it would have fixed a lot of it. But you know what's happened? The legislative branch gets involved. And they're like, all right, well, the guidelines are gone. So what we're going to do is just make it as a statute. We're going to create mandatory minimum sentencing.
Mm-hmm.
And what that does, and what you're talking about is, you know, in Ohio, we have the General Assembly, but in feds, we have Congress. Some elected official is going to say, I'm going to pass a law that makes it 20 years if you're convicted of this crime, no matter what. What that judge is really saying is, politician is really saying is, I'm going to remove from the judge the discretion to decide what the sentence should be. And this is contrary, I think, in a huge way to what our founders would have done. I mean, this is contrary to federalism. So who knows best, I would ask you, or rhetorically, about Bob Jones in Delaware County, Ohio, in that community, and what that person has done, what that person hasn't done. I mean, it would be the judge, right?
So it's supposed to be.
The idea is the smaller you shrink the community, the more information that judge has to make a decision about sentencing. And when Congress does stuff like this, when the legislative branch does stuff like this, they are effectively eliminating the separation of powers. Now, in federal court, eventually the judicial branch took care of that problem and ruled the guidelines unconstitutional. And they said, you can't do this. I'm not going into why, but the guidelines are now advisory, and we're back to the old system where the judges can use their discretion. And now we've got this sort of cat and mouse game between the legislative branch, pick a law named after somebody, and the judicial side is saying we want to do different things. So that's the other problem in the milkshake that is often not discussed.
And I think it happens here in Ohio. So for whatever reason, 99.9% of my practice has been in state court. And when we first started, we had just switched over to definite sentencing, because indefinite sentencing in Ohio had led to prison overcrowding and too many people in prison, and we wanted to reduce those numbers. So 1996, right about the time we first started, we get Senate Bill 1. And that changed the way sentencing was done in Ohio, and now we have these definite numbers. But then that wasn't working. So then we get Reagan-Tokes, and we get this, and we get that. And now we have some indefinite sentencing and some definite sentencing, and we have mandatory minimums, especially with respect to gun specifications, and we have with respect to narcotics cases. And each time it takes more and more discretion away from a prosecutor and away from a judge, because the politician stands up and they think that they know what's right. So they're going to make it, well, if you have this much cocaine and you're near a school, you have to go to prison for this. Well, all right, the idea that you don't want people selling cocaine to fourth graders is a great idea. The fact that someone has a house set up three blocks from a school, not selling to anybody associated with the school, near the school, right, or anything. But now that penalty is enhanced because they're within so many arbitrary feet of a school.
Yeah.
Because some politician was able to stand up and say, we made schools safer.
We made schools safer, right.
And you can't have a gun in a school zone. Okay, we don't want school shootings. Nobody wants school shootings. But outlawing a gun in a school safety zone, which the Supreme Court turned down as unconstitutional, at least from the federal standpoint, was these are all these knee-jerk reactions to be able to say that they did something.
And the problem is they were fixing a problem that didn't exist. Because, first of all, everybody in the system would know. So I've got a case, and you're the prosecutor, I'm the defense lawyer. My client was caught red-handed selling dope to school kids outside the school. All right, I'm here to tell you that even the most liberal judge, or the most, I don't want to say liberal.
Progressive.
The lightest sentencing judge, I'll call it, because I don't think it even is politically, most of the time. The lightest sentencing judge is going to look at that and say, this guy is going to get jackhammered.
Yep.
He was selling drugs to kids at school. We didn't need a law specifically to address it because the law did address it. But by creating a law that addresses it, the opposite happens. You grab people in a dragnet that probably shouldn't have that kind of...
I knew law enforcement officers when I was an assistant prosecutor in a county, not Franklin, who would specifically bring the drug dealer to a specific address to conduct the undercover buy,
right,
so they knew it was within 100 feet of a school.
This is the problem, and you know, you could say that's the prosecutor, you know, the prosecutor's charging this and they shouldn't, and they're forcing somebody to plead guilty to something, and that's the plea bargain problem. You can say that the General Assembly has screwed this up because now they've created this law that is getting used in ways that wasn't intended, or you could say that the judge is being too whatever. Every time one side tries to fix it, it disrupts the balance and it starts to leak somewhere else.
Exactly. I mean, legitimately, I had conversations with cops. Like,
that's unbelievable.
Stop doing this.
Right.
I'm not going to charge that. Stop doing this. This is ridiculous.
Well, you're a good prosecutor because the spirit of that law is to prevent the guy, it's two, right? To prevent the drug dealing to school kids, but also get the violence away from the schools.
Right.
All right. But bringing somebody there, it's close to entrapment.
At 9 o'clock at night when there's nobody at the school and you just to get within that arbitrary distance is ridiculous. And I told the cops to stop doing it because
I'll give you another one that I've always said. As soon as we created a sex offender registry in Ohio, so I had sex cases pre-registry and sex cases post-registry. Here's what's happened. That has been in the General Assembly in all its wisdom says, all right, if you're convicted of a sex offense, you're going to be on this reporting. We're going to tell all the neighbors and whatever it is. And that happened to grab people in its dragnet, like the 17-year-old or like the kids this isn't a defense of a date rape scenario, but those people generally aren't predators. They got drunk and he thought she said yes, she said no, and maybe he's guilty, maybe he's not. He gets convicted. Now he's on a registry for the rest of his life. So here's what's happened when you were prosecutor during this time. I started negotiating non-sex offenses because everybody knew that I would have to go fight the fight in court and maybe win if it was a registrable offense.
Mm-hmm.
So I think what happened as a result of that, I've not seen stats, I'm guessing, at least to some extent, there are probably fewer sex offense convictions because we're avoiding the registry by pleading to non-sex felonies.
I think originally when that first happened, I think there were prosecutors that were open to that. My experience in the last 9 years or so that I've been doing defense work, it never happens. The attempt to get a non-sex offense, at least with the cases that I've had, and it's purely, you know, anecdotal, there's no studies about
it. Sure, we're just personal experience.
The even mention of a non-sex offense, there has to be some significant flaw in the case.
Yeah, right. So if it's a horrible case, I guess I'm talking about the marginal cases.
Not even it has to be a significant flaw in the case. They're not.
That's right.
They're the marginal cases now where we used to be able to negotiate. There's no negotiation.
And then I would say, as a defense lawyer, and maybe the defense bar is somewhat responsible for this. If there's that big of a flaw where you're going to take a child rape case and make it a misdemeanor, then we should be saying dismiss the effing thing.
Oh, yeah.
You can't prove it. So everybody knows what this really means.
And what it comes down to is, again, you're putting people in charge of the system. So you have a prosecutor who's never going to dismiss it because, one, that might be a black mark on him or her with respect to her supervisors in the elected office. Yeah,
yep.
And then you run the risk of bringing 12 people in who are going to hear this allegation. And regardless of the flaw in the case, are going to come into it expecting you to prove your client innocent. And you may not always be able to do that.
That's right. So you end up with some plea bargain to a misdemeanor sex offense, and you're thinking, this isn't fair. So, and that's how people end up pleading guilty.
Because the risk would be getting convicted of rape and going to prison for the rest of your life, which does happen, even though it never happened.
It never happens, except it does happen. So one other thing we'll talk about, and there's another plea bargain that I think is at least worthy of sort of the footnote here. Somebody says, I'm going to plead guilty, but I'm only going to plead guilty because I want to avoid this ridiculous risk of trial. So I'm going to plead guilty, but I'm really innocent. And it's under North Carolina versus Alford, mm-hmm. A-L-F-O-R-D. It's a U.S. Supreme Court case that says you can do that, or it's not, the courts can't necessarily stop it.
Right.
It means nothing other than
it's a guilty plea.
I'm guilty, but I didn't do it, but it's still a guilty plea and somebody's still convicted. So as a prosecutor, some prosecutors hate those. Some judges hate them. What was your take on them?
It's a guilty plea. I understand you're saying that you're innocent. That's fine. You're still going to stand up there and say that there are enough facts for the state to convict you of this offense.
Yeah.
That's a guilty plea. If you want to admit guilt based on North Carolina versus Alford, fine. I never really got hung up on that as a prosecutor for whatever reason. Maybe I should have, but my thought process was, here's the evidence. Here's an offer that I made that I always thought was reasonable. If that's what you want to do, fine. If not, we'll bring a jury up at 1:30 and we'll go and we'll have some fun. But I always tried to be reasonable. And I think that when I left the Franklin County Prosecutor's Office, one of the best compliments I got was that I was one of the reasonable prosecutors that
you
was
were.
There.
Yeah.
To me,
not a pushover.
No, I was not going to just roll over, but I was reasonable. I would stick to my guns when I needed to, but I wasn't going to pick a fight just to pick a fight. And as a defense attorney, I like to think I'm the same way. I'm reasonable. I'm going to try and resolve cases if I can, and I'll pick the fights that I need to pick because that's what's going to be best for my client. That's what was going to be best for the victims and things along those lines. Emily didn't need to testify against her dad to set her mom on fire, just so that I could get a notch on my belt that I got a death penalty verdict.
Right. There was good reason for that.
My client maybe needs to take a plea because it's going to be better for him in the long run because I can't undo some of the things that he's done. I can pick the fights I need to pick, but at the end of the day, it may be better for him for me to resolve time and negotiate time because to lose is going to cost him so much more.
It you know, to sum this up, as I've been sitting here thinking about this as we're talking about it, it really is, there's no good way here to say, let me say, it would be a complete disaster if you said, we're going to get rid of all plea bargaining.
Yeah.
It would be a complete disaster to go the other direction. And I'm a woodworker, and anybody who's built a frame, a picture frame with perfect 45s, knows that if you have one imperfect 45 and you try to fix it by making the other one 46, well, then the next one's off, and then the next one's off. And then pretty soon you've got to start over. It doesn't work. The more we tweak this, the worse it gets. And I think there's what's happened is the General Assembly doesn't trust the judges. The judges don't trust the prosecutors. The prosecutors don't say the defense lawyers are no good. Right. You know, it's like this thing. The system is imperfect. I've said this 100 times. I've never claimed that we have the perfect system, only the best.
Right.
And it's sort of like maybe your relationship status on social media. It's complicated.
And what I think the solution might be, to be perfectly honest, is, and it's never going to happen, it's a pipe dream, is to just try and take the politics out of it, right?
Mm, yeah.
But that's never going to happen because we have the
politics. It's only getting worse.
No, the politics are baked into every aspect of our society right now. And until we can step away from a little bit of that and realize we don't need 8 different ways of charging a theft offense.
Yeah.
Then maybe we can actually come back to some semblance of getting back to what our founders originally thought our criminal justice system would look like.
And to those who are going to accuse us of saying, you guys are just part of the system, you're just doing it, you're part of the corruption, you're this, everybody's in bed together, it's all bull. It's not, and I'm not.
No.
Right. I have fought the fight. You fought the fight. We have fought the fight against the system. but I don't get to stand up like a sovereign citizen and say, I'm not going to play. We play within it. I can't change it. Now, good or bad, that's just what it is.
And we change it by doing what we do. We change it by making sure we protect our clients the best we can, to try the cases we have to try, to put on the best cases we can when we do go to trial, and to wake up every day with the idea and the ambition of doing the best you can for your client that day.
Yep.
Today may not be the best day, but tomorrow might be better. And that's all we can do. And as people, that's what we do every day. So the system is based on us, and we just have to try and be the best people we can.
Well, you heard it here. We've solved all the problems right here in this episode of Lawyer Talk. So if you're out there debating your buddy on the bar stool about plea bargaining, send him here. Check it out. And like and share, too, by the way. This is Lawyer Talk. Thanks, Paul.
No problem. My pleasure.
Off the record, on the air, till now. By the way, we're sponsored by Circle 270 Media. Phenomenal. If you've got a podcast that you want, if you're in the Central Ohio area, even nationally, great podcast consultant, check out Circle 270 Media. Brett over there will take care of you.